Our prayer is that by the blessings of Saraswati, Narayan, and all the other devotees, that somehow or other by this regular hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam, that all the inauspicious things in our heart can be destroyed to nil. So we're reading from the 6th canto, chapter 9, the appearance of the demon Vritrasura, and we're on verse 2 till I'm going to bite the bullet and read 2 until 10. Savai Barhishi Devabhyo Bhagavan Pratyakshamuchakai Adadadyasya Pitaro Devasa Prashayam Nripa Saha He Vishvarupa. Vai, indeed. Barhishi, in the sacrificial fire. Devibhya, unto the particular demigods. Bhagam, the proper share. Pratyaksham, visibly. Uchakai, by loud chanting of the mantras. Adadat, offered. Yasya, of whom? Pitara, the fathers. Deva, demigods. Saprashrayam, very humbly in a gentle voice. Nripa, O King Parikshit. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. O Maharaj Parikshit, the demigods were related to Vishvarup from his father's side, and therefore he visibly offered clarified butter in the fire while chanting mantras such as Indraya Idam Swaha, this is meant for King Indra, and Idam Agnaye, this is for the demigod of fire. He loudly chanted these mantras and offered each of the demigods his proper share. Text 3. Although offering clarified butter in the sacrificial fire, in the name of the demigods, without the knowledge of the demigods, he also offered oblations to the demons, because they were his relatives through his mother. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Because of Vishvarupa's affection for the families of both the demigods and the demons, he appeased the Supreme Lord on behalf of both dynasties. When he offered oblations in the fire on behalf of the Asuras, he did so secretly, without the knowledge of the demigods. Text 4. Once upon a time, however, the king of heaven, Indra, understood that Vishvarupa was secretly cheating the demigods by offering oblations on behalf of the demons. He became extremely afraid of being defeated by the demons, and in great anger at Vishvarupa, he cut Vishvarupa's 3 heads from his shoulders. Text 5. Thereafter, the head meant for drinking somarasa was transformed into a kapinjala, Franklin partridge. Similarly, the head meant for drinking wine was transformed into a kalavinka, a sparrow. And the head meant for eating food became a titiri, or a common partridge. Text 6. Although Indra was so powerful that he could neutralize the sinful reactions for killing a brahmana, he repentantly accepted the burden of these reactions with folded hands. He suffered for 1 year, and then to purify himself, he distributed the reactions for the sinful killing among the earth, water, trees, and women. Text 7. In return for King Indra's benediction, that ditches in the earth would be filled automatically, the land accepted 1/4 of the sinful reactions for killing a brahmana. Because of these sinful reactions, we find many deserts, on the surface of the earth. Purport. Because deserts are manifestations of the earth's disease condition, no auspicious ritualistic ceremony can be performed in a desert. Persons destined to live in deserts are understood to be sharing the reactions for the sin of brahmahatya, the killing of a brahmana. Text 8. In return for Indra's benediction that their branches and twigs would grow back when trimmed, the trees accepted 1/4 of the reactions for killing a brahmana. These reactions are visible in the flowing of sap from trees. Therefore, one is forbidden to drink this sap. Text 9. In return for Lord Indra's benediction that they would be able to enjoy lusty desires continuously, even during pregnancy, for as long as sex is not injurious to the embryo, women accepted 1/4 of the sinful reaction. As a result of these reactions, women manifest the signs of menstruation every month. Purport. Women as a class are very lusty, and apparently their continuous lusty desires are never satisfied. In return for Lord Indra's benediction that there would be no cessation to their lusty desires, women accepted 1/4 of the sinful reactions for killing a brahmana. And the last one. In return for King Indra's benediction that water would increase the volume of other substances with which it was mixed, water accepted 1/4 of the sinful reactions. Therefore, there are bubbles and foam in water. When one collects water, these should be avoided. Purport. If water is mixed with milk, fruit juice, or other similar substances, it increases their volume and no one can understand which has increased. In return for this benediction, water accepted 1/4 of Indra's sinful reactions. These sinful reactions are visible in foam and bubbles. Therefore, one should avoid foam and bubbles while collecting drinking water. So first I was thinking, why me? Why did I get this section? And then I thought, better me than somebody else. So here we see that Vishwarupa is secretly offering oblations to the demigods and secretly offering to the demons while apparently offering oblations for the benefit of the demigods. And Indra becomes very, very upset with this because we don't want the demigods to benefit. The demons to benefit. Because we see later on in the pastime of Bali Maharaj that the demons actually very nicely worshipped their guru, and they got so much power that they were able to overtake the heavenly kingdoms and live in Indraloka, and all the demigods had to move out. So Indra was always very carefully guarding that the demons didn't get more power so that they could retain the rule of the universe. And that's good, because when demoniac persons rule the universe, as we know from the desire of Hiranyakashipu, he had this desire that the demons rule, and that if you do sinful things, you'll get wonderful benefits. He wanted to switch it around. If you do bad things, you'll be able to get all kinds of opulence and material enjoyment. So the demigods like to keep it that one should perform pious activities and advance nicely in spiritual life. So they like to keep control. So Indra was very upset. But it's not really his right to kill a brahmana. So he decided to take these drastic measures of killing Vishwarupa. But when one kills a brahmana, there is going to be a sinful reaction. So it's described here that Indra was very powerful, and he may have been able to neutralize that sinful reaction, but he understood that it's going to come sooner or later, and better you know, I take my reaction, because it is wrong to kill brahmanas. So he suffered for 1 year, and then he thought, well, I have to carry on with my duties. I better purify myself from any more reactions and deposit these sins in various places. So he decided to deposit some of his sinful reaction in the earth. And in order to compensate for the sinful reaction manifesting as dry deserts in some locations, he also gave the benediction that if one dug a ditch and there was water nearby, that it would automatically fill up with water. So even though there's deserts, there's still ability to get water. And he gave some of the sinful reaction to trees. And so, therefore, it's understood that the sap of trees carries some sinful reaction. But in order to give them also a benediction, he gave the blessing that if you cut a tree, it will continue to grow back. So don't ask me about eating maple syrup. We come from Canada, you know, maple syrup's really good and we like our maple syrup, so I'm not going to make any comment on that. No questions on maple syrup. Because I don't honestly know the answer. So then we see that he also deposited some of the sinful reaction in water. And therefore we understand that where water is, there's lots of foam and lots of bubbles. You know, we naturally don't want to take that. We just inherently don't drink where there's a foamy water. But he also gave them the benediction of water, that if you mix water with juice or anything else, it will mix very nicely and increase the volume of the other substance, and you won't be able to tell the difference between the juice and the water. So he gave the benediction. And then he also deposited some of his sinful reaction to us ladies. And so as a result of that, we get stuck with our monthly cycles. And, you know, it's understood that at that time, some contamination is there. So therefore, the scriptures advise that it's not maybe the best time to engage in deity worship. So Srila Prabhupada requested that in temples where there are enough pujaris, that women not go on the altar at the time when they're in this state. Although he did say that if there is insufficient pujaris, it is better that the deity be worshipped than not be worshipped. But the understanding is there that some contamination is there. And according to Ayurveda, we understand that the contamination is due to the bodily secretions. It also, though, manifests as a little bit of mental contamination, where sometimes we have a harder time to discriminate on what is factual and what isn't factual. So if we perform deity worship at that time, it may not also be in the best consciousness. So it might be a better time to, you know, rest and internally reflect on, you know, spiritual values in life. And then we got this lovely controversial benediction that if a lady chooses to enjoy and engage in sexual activity during pregnancy, it could still be enjoyable. So we want to make sure that we take everything in the scriptures in the context in which it is intended. And as my husband was saying yesterday, that scriptures are meant for us to understand how we can make advancement, not for us to judge others. So we don't want to, you know, take this and make this blanket statement that all women are extremely lusty. It's understood that in the material world, we all have the desire for enjoyment. And material enjoyment for our own sense gratification, no matter what it looks like, is defined as lust. Because it is not being offered for the pleasure of Krishna. So, Prabhupada's commenting that women apparently have continuous lusty desires. So if you'd like my take on that, instead of having to make a judgment, my understanding is that as ladies, we like things to be nice, we like them to be comfortable, we like them to be enjoyable. So sometimes we also, there's also a statement in the Shastras that women are 7 times lustier than men. Now that's pretty hard to understand because, you know, you guys have your challenges. And, you know, in general, it's kind of assume that men even have more lust than women for sexual enjoyment. For us ladies, it's more spread out, you know. We like the nice sari. We like the nice jewelry. We like the home to look good. We like things to be comfortable. When we're in a situation, in a relationship, we want it to be nice and enjoyable. It's maybe not so particular for a man that everything's comfortable, everything's enjoyable. You maybe more need to lord it over and control, and, you know, you have your own challenges. And we have ours that we like things to be comfortable and enjoyable. So we see that when Ramachandra was going to go to the forest and Sita said, no, I must come with you. Ram said, but how will you ever manage in the forest? You are used to, you know, comforts and nice living and it's just going to be so hard for you. So, you know, it's understood that it's a little bit more difficult for us to live without comfortable situations. So we see that a safe way to approach these kinds of verses is that material nature is in a constant flux. And statements that are social constructs in the Bhagavatam about the psychology of men and women, it's possible that they are more pertinent to particular times because psychology is very much dependent on the social atmosphere that one lives in. And as Kali Yuga progresses, we see how the natures of men and women are very, very mixed up, and there's so many reasons for this. But the impact is that we have to deal with the current psychology of who we are and who other people are that arise out of the circumstances in which we live. And that's actually the essence of Varnashram, that we engage people according to our psychophysical natures. So we have to understand each individual's personal psychological nature. And stereotypes are not really that useful in the times that we live in. Shushi Gorni Tai Ki Jai, Shushi Pancha Tattva Ki Jai. Most beautiful, aren't they? So it's very important that we not be impersonalists, or that we don't have stereotypical judgments or stereotypical expectations. You know, we want to apply Vaishnava etiquette and behaviors in all of our circumstances and not make judgments and stereotype each other. So we know that the essence of good relationships is this Trinada Peace Unichena, Tarora Peace Ahishnuna, Amanena, Manidena, Kirtaniya Sadahari. That we need to be humble, see what faults we have, see that we are, whatever good qualities we have, are only due to the grace of Panchatattva. And not to have some false prestige that we are the enjoyer or we are deserving all of these material comforts. And that we have to be tolerant if other people should offend us, if we don't get all the things the way we like them, and respectful of each other. And that is the main guidelines for all of our interactions as devotees in order to advance in this material world. So we will see that our psychophysical natures are very much influenced by the modes of nature. Those in the mode of passion would deal with their lusty desires in one way. Those in the mode of ignorance will deal with them in another way. Those in the mode of goodness will deal with them in another way. So we can't make these blanket statements. But rather we need to understand that we don't want to operate according to our desires to enjoy in this material world. But rather we want to operate out of love and affection and duty to engage in devotional service to the Supreme Lord. So we understand that in this material world, there's so many sinful reactions that we may have to suffer while living in this material world, because every action in this material world, whether good or bad, is actually sinful. And it will produce some reaction. And those reactions might be waiting to take effect. They might be a little bit dormant and going to come later. Or they still might be in a seed state and will fructify at a much later date. We have actually no idea when and how many sinful reactions we will experience in material existence. So we see that some scriptures understand that so much suffering comes from sinful reactions that they have processes where they atone for their sinful reactions so that the suffering will be less. So in many religions, you perform so many sacrifices or religious rituals in order to get rid of your sins. Maybe you come and you confess them before a priest, and the priest, you know, helps you to nullify them. In the Vedas, you may, you know, do so many austerities, you know, perform meditation in front of hot fires, or, you know, do so many very austere things. And these may decrease our sinful reactions to some degree. But we see that when Sukadev Goswami was trying to explain that one should atone for one's sinful reactions, he was dubious. He said, we see that even though someone may atone for a sinful reaction, they still have the desire to enjoy in these ways. So they go out and do it again. And he compared it to like an elephant taking a bath and then coming out and rolling in the dust. He's all dirty again. So Maharaj Pariksit said, I don't think atonement is enough. You know, we can get rid of the sin. We're just going to make another sin and get more sinful reactions. So I don't really think, I don't buy that. So Sukadev Goswami said, you are a very intelligent disciple. It is true that one can never really gain relief from sinful reactions unless one purifies oneself from the desire for these. So we understand that in material existence, desire is always there. We can never get rid of desire. Once one man, I don't know if he was a brahmachari or grihasta, he was in Srila Prabhupada's room, and he was pretty happy. He was, you know, taking good care of his, you know, sex desire. And he said, "Srila Prabhupada, I no longer have any sex desire." And Srila Prabhupada said, "What, you're a stone?" Like, just getting rid of desire in material bodies is not really possible. But what we can do is we can convert those desires to the desire to please the Lord. So therefore, Sukadev Goswami, he quoted the verse, Kechet Kevalaya Bhakta Vasudeva Parayanaha Agam Dunva Tikartsneya Niharam Eva Bhaskara. That, you know, it's very rare that a person can get rid of his sinful reactions. The only way to do it is by adopting the purifying process of devotional service. And it is only pure, unalloyed devotional service that can uproot those weeds that are going to keep sprouting up with no possibility that they will return. So we have a garden, and we have this wonderful plant called alfalfa, which is great. It's got lots of nutrients. It has really deep roots. It can get all the minerals from the deep soil. Great for feeding horses, your cows, great food. But if it gets in your garden and you kind of just, you know, break it off and pull it up, the next thing you know, that root is so deep-rooted that it's going to be growing again. And there's that alfalfa again, overcoming all your other plants. So our material desires are like that. They're so deep-rooted that it's almost impossible through any sort of material endeavor to get rid of those desires. So it's only by pure unalloyed devotional service that we can get perfection and purification from these desires. So there's one verse that says that even by one uttering of the Hare Krishna mantra, one can be relieved of more sins than one can commit. So we have to take great solace and great faith that by chanting the holy name with love and focus, we will be able to uproot these tendencies to want to engage in material enjoyment. And Prabhupada said that because these desires are so deep-rooted, we should be very careful not to give up chanting. And when we do take to the process of bhakti, we understand that even though there's so much sinful reaction, Krishna can, by that surrendering process, take away all of our sinful reactions. So we have that verse, Sarva Dharma Parichaja, Mame Kam Saranam Raja, that Krishna can take away all of our sinful reactions. So one could think, well, how is it that it can be like that? So Srila Prabhupada said that those sinful reactions are gone as long as we surrender. So we cannot think that that surrendering process just happens once, and then, oh, we don't have any more sinful reactions, so we can enjoy. But rather, surrender means that that surrendering process is continual and that we continue to engage in devotional service. Otherwise, if we give up the engagement of devotional service, again, those roots of sinful desires are going to start to manifest, and we may have to again undergo some sinful reaction. Srila Prabhupada, though, also says that Krishna is very kind, and he understands that we have been habituated to engage in material desires since time immemorial. So sometimes we have habits for bad engagements. And Krishna understands that. And sometimes if out of habit we again do things that aren't so desirable for devotional service, Krishna will forgive us because it's just kind of a habit. But we don't want to take advantage. Otherwise, that is nama aparad, that we are just committing sins on the strength of chanting the holy name. But the point is that we have to be determined to very devotedly engage in the process of devotional service to thoroughly cleanse our hearts. So we understand that by the process of initiation, that surrendering process is solidified. Because it's by the instructions of a pure devotee that we understand how to surrender to Krishna. So surrender is actually really defined as taking initiation and guidance from a spiritual master and understanding how to apply the process of devotional service. So at that time, the guru is so magnanimous that they will take upon themselves the results that you would have gotten for your sinful activities. And it's described that just like if I pulled out this plug, you wouldn't get any more power here anymore. Or it's often said that if you pull out the fan, that the fan will, you know, gradually stop to rotate. So when we take initiation, we no longer are receiving the results that would be due to us for our sinful activities. But Krishna understands that we still might be habituated to those desires in our mind and therefore occasionally or accidentally commit them. So sometimes Krishna will manifest seeming reactions that would be very similar to the reactions that we would have gotten in material life because of those latent desires in our consciousness to still enjoy in those same ways that we wanted to. So Krishna sometimes gives us some token reactions to purify our consciousness from those habitual desires to enjoy in the ways which in this particular time, body, and circumstances that we have, desires for. So devotional service is so wonderful. And by the mercy of the Panchatattva, our desires for material enjoyment can be instantly removed. And we see that in the pastime of Jagai and Madai, that you could not commit more sinful activities than Jagai and Madai. It's described that Chitragupta, who is the servant of Yamaraj, who keeps records of everybody's activities, that he commented that Jagai and Madai wear out all of the staff that we have. We have to hire extra staff, you know, to keep track of their sinful reactions. And we have to rent more storage facilities for all the volumes of manuals that we have to write when we write down the record of their sinful reactions. So somehow or other, this magnanimous nature of Nityananda was that he instantly took all their sinful reactions. And because he blessed because Jagai stopped Madai? Yes, from harming Nityananda, then Lord Chaitanya instantly forgave him. But when Madai said, "I also want to be forgiven," because he could see the effulgence of his brother and the complete transformation. And Lord Chaitanya said, "I'm sorry. You have harmed my most dear associate, Nityananda. So nothing I can do for you." He said, only if Nityananda will forgive you. So Madai went to Nityananda, and Nityananda said, no problem, just a small thing. I want to see you worship Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because that there's nothing more wonderful in this life, in this entire universe. So I want that you have that experience to worship my Lord, Sri Chaitanya. And so he said, I will immediately forgive you. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instantly accepted them as his devotees and took them back I think it was probably Srivasangam. And there they engaged in this phenomenal kirtan like you've never experienced in your life. And Jagai and Madai were dancing along with all of the eternal associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, nobody should ever judge them according to their past lives. That they are completely purified and do not doubt this. And so Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he touched Jagai and Madai. And when he touched them, his whole body started to become black from bottom to top, just as he was absorbing their sins. And he actually looked like Krishna. And so the devotees were completely in awe. And then he said, and I need to get rid of this sinful reaction, so I will give it to all of those people who blaspheme the Vaishnavas. And then the devotees could see, again, that golden color of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu coming back. And all of the sins have gone to those who blaspheme Vaishnavas. So we want to be very careful that we don't blaspheme Vaishnavas. So we see that Nityananda has that special potency, and Nityananda manifests himself also as the spiritual master. That Narottam Das Thakur has said in the Gauranga Bolite Habi, he sings this line, Arakabai Nitai Chand Koruna Koribe Samsara Vasana Mor Kabe Morakabe Tuche. That this samsara vasana, this deep-rooted desire for material enjoyment, it's so deep-rooted that it take lifetimes to get rid of. But by the mercy of Lord Nityananda, all of these desires for material enjoyment will just seem insignificant. And instead, our real pleasure will come from the service to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sri Krishna, and all of the our Vaishnava Acharyas. So we want to pray that we can be steadfast in our devotion so that we can offer some service to our spiritual master, and also so that we don't again become entangled in material life. So, thank you very much for your kind attention. If anyone has any further comments or realizations.
Hare Krishna. I have a question about this topic of sexual desires and celibacy. Mm-hmm. It is in our philosophy that we should organize 3/4 of life in celibacy and 1/4 in Grihastha Ashram, mm-hmm. and that our society should be mostly based on celibate role models and things like that. But then what to do with the dark side of this celibacy? Because we see that people who are technically good celibate, they sometimes become very impersonal, cruel, a lot of anger they have, or they become obsessed with controlling mentality and things like that. So is all celibacy good for devotional service, or there's maybe some kind of unproductive celibacy mm-hmm. in this sense?
It's not so much the celibacy or the not celibacy. It's more the attitude in the mind. Because it's our consciousness that's having the problem. you know, we want our material enjoyment. So if we think that we're just going to squash all of our material desires, Prabhupada was saying, what are you, a rock? It's not very realistic. Rather, we have to transform those desires into desires to want to serve the Supreme Lord. Now, if we just squash them and we don't utilize them in the proper way, they are going to make us hard-hearted and impersonal. So they actually need to be transformed. Because Prabhupada says we have this lust must be transformed into love of Godhead, not just squashed. Because we know, you know, if we clean and we just sweep things under the carpet, and we keep sweeping and sweeping and sweeping, we get a pretty big bump. And one day we're going to be walking and we're going to trip over it. So just negating our desires isn't going to work. Rather, we need to transform them by getting true taste for engaging in devotional service. Sometimes we have different bodies which just have different energies. And everybody is different. If you have a lot of energy, usually you have a lot of energy in all spheres of life. And sometimes we need to figure out how to utilize all of those energies in the service of the Lord. So if one is not able to transform our lust directly into loving engagement in the service of the Lord, and it needs a little bit more purification, sometimes, not sometimes, but very often, we need to take up that grihastha ashram. And the grihastha ashram, even though it is only one of four ashrams, it's usually comprising about 90% of the population. Because most people need to purify sex desire in other ways also. So in grihastha ashram, sexual and sex life is allowed because we are taking responsibility. We see that outside of marriage, it is not allowed because you're not taking responsibility. Some child can be born. Who's going to look after it? What's the woman going to do? Creates chaos. But in the grihastha ashram, if you take responsibility, you look after your wife, you look after your children, you raise them in Krishna consciousness, that sacrifice can purify that desire. And then it will be transformed and we can progress in developing our love of God and not have that as an impediment. So we all have to look deep within our heart and see how we can get purified. Because ultimately it's up to us to take the path of purification. So we should look deeply. And a good time to look deeply is at the age of 25. Because then you have some opportunity to choose. And, you know, if you need to enter grihastha ashram, there's some time to make some arrangements. So I think that everybody at that critical age should do some deep introspection and see, how am I best going to advance in devotional life? So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.